The name of my piece is Gossip. It's a memoir. An escapade that Blandford, Massachusetts townspeople considered scandalous was not really scandalous at all. It happened in the early 1950s, during summer after eighth grade. The school superintendent's daughter Janice, my best friend Karen, and I came up with a plan. We decided to attend a square dance at the Grange Hall in the Mountain Village and afterwards stay overnight at Janice's house. The Grange Hall event was enjoyable. A live band played on stage. My most frequent partner was Ronnie, who lived in Blandford and was 6 months younger. Karen and Janice also had teenage friends from the village, whom they danced with much of the time. None of us had a boyfriend at the event. During intermission, we girls got together with our friends, Ronnie 13, Peter 14, and Hank 17, and hatched what we thought was an exciting scheme. When the dance ended at 11, we would walk the short distance to Janice's house. Then at 2 a.m., after her parents fell asleep, we would sneak out and meet the boys in front of People's General Store about a quarter mile away. Karen's friend Hank owned a Ford pickup that would fit all of us, Hank and Karen in front and the other two couples in the truck bed. He would take us riding and we would return at 4. My parents and little brother are sound sleepers, Janice said. They'll never wake up and realize we're gone. We wanted to do something exciting our parents would forbid if they had a hint of what was going on. So far, they'd prohibited us from going out alone on dates. This adventure would resemble a date. At 11, we three girls walked to Janice's one-story ranch house. Her parents were up waiting for us. After eating a snack and brushing our teeth, we pretended to settle down for the night. We went to Janice's room. She climbed in her bed, and Karen and I lay down on a mattress on the floor. We stayed quiet, as if asleep. But none of us slept a wink. A little before 2, we dressed silently, putting on shorts, t-shirts, and sneakers. Feeling elated and fearful, we slowly crept down the hall past Janice's 9-year-old brother's room. He didn't seem to wake. We very quietly opened the front door. Fortunately, the hinges were well oiled and didn't creak. We stepped out onto the front porch, closing the door gently. There was no need to lock it. Blandford families didn't bother to lock their doors. Partners were in the truck bed. They had brought blankets to cover us and cushioned the ride on hard steel. Karen climbed to the front seat with Hank. Peter and Janice and Ronnie and I lay down on a blanket in the truck bed and pulled another one over us. We left immediately. Blandford had no restaurants or bars, and at that late hour, nothing was open in the closest city, Westfield, so we took off on gravel roads. The Blandford Township, with a summer population of about 1,200, had more than 100 miles of unpaved roads, a vast network. Until that night, I didn't realize you could travel at least 2 hours without traversing any particular route more than once. One road led 10 miles to North Blandford, another 7 miles to Cabo Mountain Reservoir, and even farther as it skirted the reservoir. Another headed toward Russell and passed by an old slate quarry filled with water. The driver, Hank, knew the back roads and had a good sense of direction, so he didn't get lost. I, however, was totally lost. There were few landmarks. As Hank drove fast on bumpy gravel, overhanging branches obstructed views of stars overhead, and we saw an occasional dark farmhouse or tar pepper shack silhouetted against the moonlit sky. But most of the time we saw nothing but outlines of black-looking forest. The air was so warm we would have felt comfortable without the blanket, and a loud chorus of crickets sounding like an orchestra accompanied us. We stopped once for a few minutes and listened to the crickets. I kissed Ronnie gently on the cheek, primarily because that was what he expected. We didn't try French kissing. I felt no special attraction to him, and he seemed to have none for me. He was not the kind of boy I would date. A year behind me in school, he was an unexceptional student who planned to work in construction. His conversation bored me. I wished I were lying next to an interesting boyfriend. at 4, Hank parked in front of Peebles' store, and we three girls, frightened, ran toward the superintendent's house. Still, all the lights were out, so it looked as if no one had detected our disappearance. We quietly opened the front door and tiptoed down the hall. Extremely relieved when we'd been able to return unobserved, we fell asleep immediately. The next morning, Dana and his very proper wife, Susan, greeted us kindly. She fixed us a huge breakfast of pancakes and bacon, and we visited for an hour while eating leisurely. Obviously, she didn't have the slightest suspicion we'd left the house during the night. We were very happy, believing we'd dodged a bullet of our own making. A week later, while picking berries at a large blueberry farm in Blandford, I talked with the owner's son, Tom. "You now have a wild reputation," he remarked, smirking. "People say you three girls slept with your boyfriends when you went out for that joyride in the pickup." Tom had a gift for gossip. He talked with everyone, poor villagers whose family had lived in Blandford for generations, as well as the rich summer people. "That's crazy," I replied indignantly. "We did nothing except very innocent kissing. Those guys weren't even boyfriends." "Janice was bleeding so much when she returned that she left a trail of blood across the carpet," they say. "Not true. Janice was in the truck bed with me and she did nothing. I know we all kept our clothes on. Besides, if Dana and Susan had seen any evidence of our disappearance, they would have been upset." "Maybe so. How did anyone find out about the escapade?" "The store owner, Mrs. Peebles, lives in an apartment above the store. When Hank's pickup pulled up and parked in front, she woke up and saw you climb in the truck. She observed your return at 4. Well, she has a wild imagination. I didn't realize she lived above the store. I could picture her business with her husband. Seeing us leave in the middle of the night was probably the most exciting thing she'd witnessed in a long time. She told all the local people," Tom said. "I felt wronged." "I know it looked bad," I said. "Driving 2 hours on narrow, bumpy dirt roads is dangerous and gave the appearance we went out to have sex. You could have run out of gas or had an accident. No one would have found you until morning." "Yes, but we didn't. And none of us made a serious move toward lovemaking. You know, we're not even interested in the boys who took us on that wild ride." "I know, but the people in the village don't know that." "Please don't repeat Mrs. Peebles' tall tale. It could get back to our parents. We could find ourselves in a lot of trouble. I might be grounded for a year." "Okay, you have my word," Tom said. I felt dismayed. I would have to tell Janice and Karen about Mrs. Peebles' tale. Hopefully, the local townspeople would not mention the incident to our parents. We hadn't dodged every bullet.
October's theme was loss. To help me focus on that, I dressed accordingly. That. Booze sometimes keeps people sane in insane times. Perhaps it was booze that sometimes kept me sane while serving in the Mekong Delta of South Vietnam. Daily life consisted of either preparing to defend the camp against attack or training our strikers, Vietnamese who volunteered to fight with American Special Forces, techniques for being more efficient and effective in combat. During the night, we set ambushes around the camp. Occasionally, there would be huge firefights where we would call in our friends, combat aircraft. True, we were isolated, but our friends could get to the camp very quickly when the proverbial stuff hit the fan. The aircraft were mostly WW2 and Korean War prop fighters. They were much better for us on the ground because they flew slower. Pilots could more easily hit targets at 200 miles an hour than they could at 500 miles per hour. Of course, it was easier for the VC to hit them at 200 miles an hour. But that was a risk those of us on the ground were willing to take. Despite protection from above, so to speak, it was a lonely life. We felt that nobody, save our immediate families, really cared that we were risking our lives for our country. We were in the middle of nowhere, while just about anyone who wanted, man, woman, or child, shot at or threw grenades at us. But such things were never spoken. Perhaps it was because we were supposed to be tough Green Berets. Or maybe it was a male thing. But the underlying question was never articulated. What the hell am I doing here? There were quiet nights when I felt I would burst with loneliness. Several of us would quietly let Bombay Bob Beer exchange reality for wings. In those moments, I was a hero, loved and respected by all. Girls waited anxiously back home for my return. We would drink and share those safe thoughts. In other words, they were total BS. By the time someone was drunk enough to say something meaningful, he was too incoherent to be understood. One such night, when we seemed to be getting exceptionally soused, I started talking about a girlfriend, and everyone really perked up. Normally, no one would have discussed such a thing. It presented too many paths back to reality. But at 19, and the youngest one on the team, all of them could listen and comment in the safety of knowing that they were worldly wise and above the longing I felt. The gathering had the feel of an all-boy junior high school party where someone had snuck in booze. Imagined and exaggerated stories of sexual conquest poured, and the whole team, all 12 of us, were discussing life like we really cared. After a while, the banter began to fray when suddenly we noticed a single bat flying above us like a devil, or maybe a guardian angel. The thatched roof of our camp building was a haven for bats. Nightly, they chased the abundant supply of insects. Bats, though somewhat creepy, were really protectors. What we could catch from those tons of insects they ate was a lot more sinister than any bat. He moved so slowly, so nonchalantly, and seemingly aimlessly against the darkened sky. He seemed so free. I guess he didn't know there was a war going on. At least not yet. Then, from out of the blue, Williams, a demolitionist, fired a round at him from his .45. Stunned at first, laughter quickly followed as the bat continued to fly, unfazed. Williams was kind of a maniac. I guess he thought we were laughing at him, so he quickly fired the remaining 7 rounds in the clip, all to no avail. At first, he was really mad, but seeing the continued flapping of the bat above us, though nothing had happened, changed his scowl to laughter. Then Colby drew his .45 with the announcement, "Let me show you how it's done." After the weapons expert's 8 rounds flew safely toward heaven, the laughter became uproarious. Williams laughed so hard that the Bombay Bob ran from his nose as the bat continued his freedom dance. All of us now realized firsthand how good bat radar was. It was the first time I had felt truly close to this group of strangers who had been thrown together to make the world safe for democracy. As I watched their smiles and laughter, I didn't feel the loneliness or anger that had inundated me for the last 4 months. Without anyone noticing, Sharkey, the team intelligence sergeant, had picked up his M2 carbine, a fully automatic rifle capable of firing about 700 rounds a minute. He was a WW2 and Korean veteran, and possibly the meanest man alive. He expended a 30-round clip within a heartbeat as the bat continued his pattern. Our laughter became uncontrollable, but instead of laughing, Sharkey loaded another clip with a sneer. He held back on the trigger until the bat was splattered across the now mirthless sky. Time ceased. We stood looking at the noble, now lifeless, torn flesh. Sharky's sneer emptied like the last drops of Bobby Bob. Warm, flat, unsatisfying. His lips, our hearts uttering, "Damn. Damn."
Okay, mine is a work of fiction. However, there was a lot of research that went into it. It's called Give Them Shelter. Charlie lost his job, but Marge still worked. Charlie was good at his job, but age discrimination is hard to prove. Then Marge got sick. She couldn't work for months. Disability didn't pay her old salary. They had to dip into the 401k. Marge got back to work, but doctor bills and prescriptions mounted, even with insurance. They applied for a reduction in their house payments and got it. They paid their bills on time, but years later they found out the bank had lost the paperwork. There were fines and their payments raised. They would not have thrown out their copy, but it was gone. When Marge had a relapse, when she returned to work, her company got ugly. They gave her jobs that she was not trained for. They nitpicked her work. They couldn't fire her for being sick, but they did fire her for poor performance. They were evicted. Charlie got a job at a local department store that gave them some insurance, but not enough money to get an apartment. They sold all their belongings, even her wedding ring, and lived in their car until it was stolen when Marge was buying groceries. Marge went to the homeless shelter. She was treated like a criminal. Charlie worked too late to stand in line to get in. He was forced to sleep outside. They only saw each other on weekends. The staff assumed they used drugs. They were forced to take classes on recovering from drug dependency. These were mandatory classes during the week when Charlie worked, so he was forced to stop using the shelter. The staff were required to have TB and flu vaccinations. Each time Marge heard a cough, she wondered what she might catch. The cots were uncomfortable. She did not sleep well. One day when she left the shelter, she was followed by two kids who pushed her into a van. They drove her to the country and raped and beat her. Then they left her. She found her leg was badly injured. She had to walk on it anyway. When she collapsed from the pain, a passing driver took pity and brought her to the clinic. They wrapped her leg and even gave her a crutch, and her walk back to the shelter was extremely painful. When she got back to the shelter, they took away the crutch. They were afraid it might be used as a weapon. Then they helped her to bed. Later that night, she needed to use the restroom. She had to crawl. There were no handicap facilities. She tried to pull herself up, but she couldn't. She wet herself. That's when something good happened. Someone told Charlie about a community of homeless people out near the interstate. He was able to buy a warm, waterproof sleeping bag. The community had formed a police force which guarded the camp. They had a couch and comfortable chairs in plastic to protect them from the rain. They even had a couple of picnic tables. Charlie had a long walk each day, but it was worth it. One thing scared Marge. There was a man called Big Bart. Big Bart never said a word. He had a baseball bat. Sometimes he pounded it on the ground for hours. Then he would sit and stare off into space. Then one day a gang of teenagers approached the camp. They had knives and boards with nails. Their police form only had sticks. Then Big Bart, baseball bat in hand, he ran wildly at the boys. He looked so insane that the boys ran in panic. He ran after them and did not return for half an hour. No one asked him if he caught up with them. Then one day, a bulldozer and a large truck came. Their furniture was hauled away and the bulldozer plowed the camp into the ground. The county councilman had reported them. They were able to collect their few belongings, but those who were not there lost everything. One man lost his wallet and his birth certificate in it, and they watched it till the camp was gone. Then they looked at each other and said in unison, "Where do we go now?"
I'm one of your neighbors from across the street, Trinity Episcopal. I wandered into the Brew Writers Group one day, and I stayed. A few years ago, we installed a pipe organ, and in order to do that, we had to take out our stained glass window. This poem is inspired by that time of removal. Jesus, come down from the window. Oh, Jesus, come down from the stained glass window where you kneel in dark red robes. Sit at my kitchen table, and I will get out the woven placemats I bought at that gift shop in the mountains and grill you a cheese sandwich, the kind my daughter Carrie likes me to make when she gets off her shift at Home Depot. I want to ask you, why did her father spark out so young in a burst of beauty and light, bright as a 4th of July pyrotechnic, while the rest of us linger in hope like marked down goods in a Walmart bin? I want you to stand in the crosswalk at Weems Elementary and tell all those people who flick around hate like cigarette butts to stop it. They've farted out all their middle-class fears about immigrants and the rest of us, for the rest of us to smell, and I'm sick of it. Wait, don't go. Stay with me. Use me. Challenge me. Exhaust me. Comfort me. Let me be your servant. Okay. Return to your glass Gethsemane if you have to. I'm patient. I have all the faith in the world that the thing I've looked for all my life will happen. It's coming any day. My transformation, my miracle, my burst of light.
My topic is identity. My name is Cindy Church. Thank you. I chose three pieces because when I thought about this topic, I realized that there are different kinds of identity, and the first one I'd like to share is about our identity as a church body or community. It's our identity as a whole when we come together for worship and service. It seems especially fitting since we have been coming together over this past year and watching stained glass windows in the sanctuary get restored. It's the identity we have when we're participating in church. Stained glass masterpiece. God is He who rinses and cleanses and crafts each colored fragile piece of shattered glass and resurrects. God is He who makes whole new life. We are made whole, each member in His body pure, beauty in heavenly colors, His gift of love to many others. God is He who molds and melts each one and binds us, one to another, each member a part of, and fashioned to become, whole through life and death and life. Raised high, made a holy image, each single member shines in spiritual sun rays, all life streaming through, each member God's masterpiece, as a stained glass window filtering in light, abandoning all darkness. And the next for me is kind of a universalist conception of God. I call it Me on God. God is in us. We are in God. One day we may become one with God, but we are not gods. God lives in us all as God's creation. His intentions dwell within our souls. Our souls reach out, touch God, and become one. But we are not God, for God is creation, while we are existence. Yet one depends upon the other, and are unified. And the last is a statement of personal identity at one point in my life. It's called the timeless 20th century woman. 2 years, she had readied herself for the question of the curious, an all-astounding question of her brassiere. Its ragged edges and formless shape, its twice-snapped hinges, its double-seaming seams. At the query's final arrival, its presentation compelled her to howl aloud in laughter. "Let me ask," put the courtier, begging her pardon, of course, "are you wearing two bras?" Aside from the peeking, all innocence, for it admittedly unusual, a nursing bra she wore, her once delicate nipples, now baby chewn and worn. Thank you.
I'm covering two topics. Doubt, whether I would ever get out of the situation I found myself in the night of the big, big snow, and laughter, because you can look back at years ago, a situation, and see the humor in it, but you didn't see it very much while you were in the middle of it. The night of the big, big snow, this was written in 2009. It was January in the mid-1960s, and I was driving a full-sized, lumbering, blue-and-white 1960s Ford across Cleveland, Ohio on the Shoreway every weekday. I was commuting to my job as a middle school music teacher in Lakewood on Cleveland's west side. Paul, my husband, and I lived in the east side of Cleveland in a rented old rambling house at the top of Mayfield Hill. It started to snow about noon, and school was dismissed an hour early. My first mistake was offering to drop one of my fellow teachers at her home in Cleveland along my way home. That delayed me just enough to put me in the thick of the fast-developing storm and right into the path of everyone else trying to make it home before the storm got any worse. It was snowing so hard that my Ford's windshield wipers could hardly keep up, even at top speed. Snow was rapidly building up in the roadway, and I had yet to see a plow or a sand truck. Soon, intersections all over downtown Cleveland were thoroughly gridlocked. My car soon was stuck 10 cars back at a four-way stop intersection. None of us were going anywhere anytime soon. I looked around at my surroundings and realized, with a sense of panic, that I was stuck, along with many others, in a dangerous neighborhood known for muggings, gangs, sleazy hotels, questionable betting parlors, and other marginal businesses. I had only a half tank of gasoline, and the temperature was in the 20s, with wind whipping through the streets, as it can only in a bad Cleveland storm, fed by the infamous Lake Erie effect. On the positive side, I was dressed in typical winter in Cleveland fashion, with heavy Lowden-style coat, thick wool gloves, and green pull-over-the-ears wool cap. But on the negative side, my boots were old, and they leaked. I let the car idle for a while and tuned in a news report. It featured Carl Stokes, mayor of Cleveland, answering why there were no plows or sand trucks out yet when the storm had been predicted. His famous response was, "I wouldn't send my men out on a night like this." This ridiculous statement only added to Cleveland's dicey reputation. Cleveland and its polluted river were already subjects of press derision. The river had actually caught fire and burned for several days before they could put the fire out. I was now down to a third of a tank of gasoline and was running my battery down with the radio. I decided to turn the car off, lock it, and walk down the road to the gas station. As soon as my feet hit the snow-covered road and sidewalk, the boots began to leak and my feet slowly turned ice cubes. I trudged along to the leers of some dangerous-looking men who were just hanging around to see what would happen. They called out to me tauntingly, "What's the matter, lady?" "Where are you going, lady?" And some even more insulting remarks referencing my appearance, parentage, and the stringy wet hair under my hat. At the gas station, I put down a $20 deposit on the gas can they loaned me because they wanted the can back for the next poor sucker nearly out of gas. Luckily, I had a $20 bill and a gas credit card so could fill the gas can. It was heavy, and the gasoline sloshed out over my coat and boots, so by the time I reached my car again, I smelled like a Standard Oil station. I struggled back down the icy road to return the can and get my deposit back. By now, it was getting dark, and I locked myself back in the car to try and defrost my feet while I listened to more disheartening reports about the progress of the storm. I already knew how bad it was. I was stuck in the middle of it. By now, Paul should be home. Unlike me, who suffered a long commute, he worked and went to graduate school at Case Western Reserve, only minutes away from our house. I looked around for a likely place to call him and saw a dreary, seedy-looking, unprepossessing-looking hotel a block or so away. I ventured out past the cat-calling male hangers-on battery to the hotel. Great, it was warm, and they had a public phone, and I had some change. Paul was home, but was quick to criticize me for not checking into a motel and instead trying to get all the way home in the storm. He also scolded me for taking my teacher friend home. So much for sympathy for my predicament. I reported the extent of the backup, and he said TV was saying the police were not allowing anyone either up or down Mayfield Hill, so it looked like I was stuck. He said he would try to come down in his Volkswagen when traffic was allowed. I described the area where I was stuck, and he advised staying locked in the car and hung up with a, "If you leave the car running too long, you will drain the battery, so be careful." Mumbling to myself that he was in a nice warm house, I started back to my car. While I was talking with Paul in the hotel, I noticed a steady procession of couples walking up the stairs together toward the hall where rooms were located. I noticed that they disappeared into the rooms but emerged in 10 or 15 minutes or so. Then the same woman would start up the stairs with another man. What was going on? Then it hit me. These had to be prostitutes and their johns, engaged in their usual practices, snow or no snow. I got out of there fast and retreated to my car. Hours passed. I now could not feel my feet. They were so wet and cold. And still no movement of car or truck or bus or any sign of plows or sand trucks. My battery was getting low, so I ran the car for short intervals and got colder and hungrier. Finally, I ran the battery down all the way and was almost out of gas again. I had eaten my lunch at 11 a.m., my usual lunch hour at school, and had already ransacked my pockets in the car for a couple of stray candy bars. Now it was 2 a.m. Did I finally hear a plow? I dug out one of my last dimes and walked over to the hotel again to check in with Paul while watching furtively for dangerous people. Fortunately, they had all retreated to warm living quarters. The couple traffic between the lobby and the hotel room floor continued, but I tried to ignore it. Paul said TV4 reported they were going to allow traffic down the hill in 30 minutes or so, and he would come down. I told him about the gas situation and the defunct power of the battery. After a few colorful phrases of blame, he hung up. I went back to the now freezing and frozen over with ice and snow car. Some of the cars ahead and behind me were now moving off, taking advantage of the now cleared road. But of course, I had no gasoline and a dead battery, so I had to wait for Paul. In about an hour, Paul and the Volkswagen appeared around the remaining stuck cars. He had brought along his heavy caving rope with the hope he could pull my Ford with his Volkswagen to the gas station. To cat calls and comments from nearby cars, he tied the two cars together and tried his planned maneuver, but the Volkswagen wasn't up to the task. Paul, never at a loss in a mechanical crisis situation, dove into his ever-on-hand toolbox and proceeded to open the Ford's hood, detach the battery, and hoist up his battered lawnmower gas can, which he handed to me. I hobbled along on my frozen feet behind him to the gas station, where it took a couple of hours to charge the battery. Back to my car, he soon had it going and gassed up. He ordered me into the Ford with dire warnings to follow him and for heaven's sakes not to stop on the hill. We moved out and easily scaled the now plowed and sanded hill. All I could think of was home, warmth, and food. We turned into our street, which was as yet unplowed or sanded, and immediately got both cars stuck in drifts that were by that time almost 4 feet deep. We looked at each other, nodded in unspoken agreement that enough was enough, and locked the cars right where they were to deal with in the morning. Finally, in our warm house, Paul opened the Christmas bottle of brandy, and we each had a hearty and warming drink while directing a few unsavory insults at the mayor. We built a fire in the living room fireplace, and my feet finally began to thaw out. Schools, businesses, and institutions did not open for 2 whole days, which was extremely unusual in Cleveland. The mayor was blamed for the whole fiasco. I do not remember whether Mayor Carl Stokes was elected to another term, but I certainly did not support him.
March's theme was power, so I'll be reading Commander-in-Chief. I cannot trust a man to control others who cannot control himself. Robert E. Lee, referring to Ulysses Grant. You steer us south through the pine tree tunnel, iced cones incoming through needles, snow, and prayers for our dead. Our feet are bloody. Our clothes are torn. We reek from the squelched fuse of understanding. We follow you like an addiction, begging for bits of regular rest, weekly bites of bread, salvation from this frozen cup, and respite from the memories of our dead.
My theme is rebellion, and I have a pair of poems here. First one is one that I wrote, and it's called Suncatcher. Harvester of divine fire appears to a mortal. Burning countenance reveals his gift. Stolen from inhabitants of Olympus, the punishment for Prometheus will be harsher than any living god has seen. The birds of prey shall lick his liver clean. A weapon against night, a beacon for all mankind, flickering red and bright, companion for all time. Onward we step into a much better age, till technology begins to engage in ways to eliminate that elemental need. Cold fluorescence eclipsed the burning seed. Is there a reason? Is there a reason for this light? Our contact with the flames reduced to a game. We have no responsibility, thanks to electricity. Will we one day perhaps return to its warmth? Will we long to bask in that glow again? Is there a reason? Is there a reason for this light? Losing it, losing it, losing it. If gratitude we lack, maybe God will take it back. But if gratitude we give, perhaps God will reinstall a better way to live from nature's hearth to all. My second piece is called In Pursuit of Ignorance, and this one was actually written by my fiance, and she said that I inspired it, so I'm going to read it. Socrates cried to me, "Oh, what bliss, fool! Salvation tried me. Conviction wipes my slate clean. Before chalkboards, sands plus stones plus abacus, count on it. What level condescension exists? Tensile reason am I? Count my errors as grains of sand. May as well throw stones at my wandering ways as sift my faults through sands of time. Magma, list layers beneath the sea. Oh, blissful earthquakes abound. Socrates cries to me when reason denies ascension.
The Last Tree. Once upon a time, many stories start once upon a time, and usually when they do, they take us back. Back to a time when something happened, something the story wants us to remember. This story starts once upon a time, but it takes us forward in time. Forward to an event that has not happened yet. To an event that may happen, though, in the days of our great-grandchildren's great-grandchildren. Once upon a time, in that time, there was a great city. For as far as the eye could see, the city stretched. Nothing but buildings and glass and concrete, for as far as the eye could see, and roadways and walkways and subways. The roar of engines, the hum of motors, and the bleat of horns, and the incessant babble of people. For as far as the mind could stretch, the city stretched. It was a great city. Everybody said so. There were no green plants in this city, except for one, in the very center of the city, completely surrounded by buildings, roadways, and people. There was one last tree. It was a huge old tree, twisted and gnarled and nearly as tall as the buildings. I don't know what miracle had occurred to allow the tree to be spared when all the others were cut down, but that miracle had occurred, and there it was, in the middle of the city, one last tree. There were no animals in the city, except, of course, for the people. There were millions and millions of people, but they, it seemed, were all sick. They went to their doctors and complained of a variety of ills, and the doctors prescribed a variety of pills, salves, and ointments, which the people took as scheduled, but the medicines did no good. So the doctors described special diets, which the people ate faithfully, but the diets did no good. And so the doctors designed special exercise plans, which the people followed religiously, but the exercises did no good. The people were still sick. The doctors could not make them well. Except for one doctor. He told his patients, go to the tree in the center of the city. Go and simply spend time with the tree. Breathe in its presence. Smell the fragrance of its leaves and blossoms. Put your arms round the tree. Press your cheek against its bark. Feel its roughness. Squeeze the tree tightly. Feel its great strength. Do this, and it will make you well. Well, the people thought, this seems a little weird, but nothing has worked. Why not? So they tried it. They went to the tree as directed. They spent time with the tree. They breathed in its presence. They put their arms round the tree, pressed their cheeks against its bark, felt its roughness. They squeezed the tree tightly and felt its great strength. And lo, it worked. The people felt instantly better. Why, they actually felt well. The people who had hugged the tree felt well. It didn't last, of course. The people still lived in the city. And soon they felt as sick as they ever had. So they went back to their doctor. It was wonderful for a while, but it didn't last. What do we do now? Go back to the tree, the doctor told them. You can go to the tree as often as you need to, and it will make you well. And so they did. Whenever they felt a little bad, they went to the tree. Some went once a month. Some went once a week. Some even went every day. It never failed to make them feel better. Now, the doctor had quite a few patients, and he sent them all to the tree. Soon there were lots of people gathered round the tree, and other doctors, seeing how successful the first doctor had started, started sending their patients to the tree as well. Soon there were lots more people around the tree. Soon there were so many people around the tree that lines had to form. And sometimes people had to wait, sometimes for quite a while. And still more people came. Soon there were so many people that the lines were always there, and the delays got longer and longer. Soon they were bringing people to the tree in busloads. Soon there were so many people trying to spend time with the tree that a law had to be passed. and the law said that no one could spend more than 15 minutes at a time with the tree. And still the people came, more and more people. Soon they had to pass another law, and this law said that no one could spend more than 1 minute at a time with the tree. And still more and more people came. From all over the city they came. Soon there were so many people crowding round the tree that no one could get next to the tree, and no one could get well. And that is the end of the story. It is a story that has not happened yet, but it may happen in the days of our great-grandchildren's great-grandchildren. And as they stand in those long, long lines, I imagine they will think back to this time, and they will say how wonderful it would have been to live in those days when there were so many trees. Do you realize that in those days there were more trees than people? Why, in those days, everyone could have had their own tree to hug. Listen to the words of our great-grandchildren's great-grandchildren. Ancient ones, know how lucky you were to have lived in a time when there were so many trees. Honor your trees. Cherish your trees. And every chance you get, spend time with a tree. Breathe in its presence. Smell the fragrance of its leaves and blossoms. Put your arms round the tree. Press your cheek against its bark and feel its roughness. Hug your tree tightly and feel its great strength. These are the words of our great-grandchildren's great-grandchildren.